You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 15, Growing the Beard. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the TOS cast talking about Star Trek's 45th anniversary, some updates on TNG on Blu-ray, Marina Certes news, and Diamond Select Toys, Picard and Borg figures. Star Trek Online going free-to-play, Sick Bays, Silicon-based alien life, and the results of our poll on which villain's name you most want to shout in battle. And in the feature, we'll be discussing one of the greatest Star Trek episodes and the turning point for TNG, the best of both worlds. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you today? It's been a whole week since you were here in the studio with me, and feels like I don't even know, some kind of time warp going on here.
I've certainly been in a time warp because I don't know, I lost hours or I gained hours or something. All I know is that I'm coming to you from Unimatrix 0WA here in Seattle, Northwest America, which is a big difference from where I've been living for the past 3 years, closer to you in Japan.
Yeah, definitely a little bit further away from me than you used to be, but good. Well, it's great to have you over there on that side of the world now, though, so we can communicate with our listeners and our followers on Twitter a bit more through kind of round the clock now.
Yeah, and this is now an international podcast.
That's true. It is an international podcast. I guess everyone thought it was kind of odd before. You got two Star Trek fans in doing a podcast from Japan, right?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, and I could tell the difference. I go out and you know, there's Star Trek, not everywhere, but there's a lot more Star Trek when I go into a comic shop or a toy shop. It's nice to finally be around people who actually know what Star Trek is.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, here about the only thing you see is maybe if you go in the video rental shop, you see a few Star Trek movies. And occasionally you get the little boxed toys that come out, you know, once every few years. And
yeah,
otherwise, boy, not a lot.
Yeah, I know.
You got to be a Star Wars fan if you want to get stuff around here in Japan.
Star Wars or Transformers. Yeah. Yeah. I saw some great stuff that I'm wanting to talk about on future episodes. A board game called Star Trek Expeditions. A comic book that was Star Trek Alien Spotlight Tribbles, which I think should excite many of our listeners.
Yeah, but not you quite. What you're hoping for is a sequel called Glommers, right?
I am. I'm going to start a write-in campaign at IDW starting today.
All right.
And everyone send some Quadra Triticale into IDW publisher Chris Rial and get him on our side.
Yes. And everyone, please tune in to CNN next week for the investigation of the mysterious substance that was shipped by Greg to IDW until they find out that it is actually Quadro Triticale.
It's like wheat. It's like wheat, guys.
Yeah. All right. Well, why don't we hop in? You know, I've been thinking all week that it's been kind of a slow news week. You know, if you check the Star Trek various news sites, pretty much everybody has a lower level of stories this week, in terms of volume, you know, than in the past. I don't know why. It just doesn't seem like there's been a whole lot going on. Of course, today, as we record this, is actually September 8th, which is the 45th anniversary of the airing of The Man Trap. So
yeah, and of course, for me, it's only the 7th because I'm living in the past, and so I'm planning my Man Trap watching party tomorrow. It may not be the best episode of Star Trek, but it was certainly the first one. Well, wait.
And it's also
it was the first
the
one
saltiest.
Aired.
Right. You know, it is true. You know, now because you're over there and with our time difference, it's kind of like we've got our perpetual TNG Time Squared episode going on all the time here. I'm Picard in the future. You're Picard slightly in the past.
Right.
but you know, even though it feels like it's been kind of a slow week, as I put together news stories for this show, I actually have quite a long list of things here for us to talk about. And the first one is something we've talked about quite a bit off and on, which is the possibility of The Next Generation being remastered in high definition and coming to Blu-ray.
Yeah, and I actually saw this. I saw this as I was looking at my tweets over the last week. This LeVar Burton really just off the cuff said that he was stopping by at, I believe it's CBS Television City, to see how the TNG, you know, HD remastering is going, which caught some of us a little off guard because it hasn't been officially announced. We've heard rumblings, especially from the Digital Bits, about this happening, but there's been no official announcement. But this is the first. I'm assuming LeVar wouldn't have said anything if it wasn't at the very least true.
Well, I think it was definitely true that he was there and that he saw them working on it. I think that this was kind of taken by a lot of people as meaning that Star Trek The Next Generation is coming to Blu-ray, like all seven seasons are coming to Blu-ray. And that may be the case. I mean, I hope that's the case. At least I hope it's coming remastered HD. But, you know, he may have just been talking about seeing what they're doing to encounter at Farpoint, because it pretty much has been confirmed that there's going to be this sampler disc with, you know, four or so episodes on it. So that may be all he's talking about. We'll have to see.
Yeah, it's been an interesting thing talking to some Star Trek fans here in Seattle and just trying to meet some more people. So many people are telling that because of the Netflix Instant Watch, their interest in Star Trek has either come out of nowhere or been reinvigorated. They've been watching especially Next Gen after not having seen it for years and years, and especially not having seen it in order.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, I monitor the hashtag Star Trek on Twitter kind of throughout the day every day. And that's what I see. I see so many people tweeting about specifically The Next Generation, and they're watching it on Netflix. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are rediscovering it.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people who it's like it's the first time that they're really watching this series, which it's amazing. I mean, it's 24 years, I think, since the premiere of The Next Generation.
Yeah.
And seeing people watching this for the first time is really exciting to me.
Yeah. Well, definitely.
Great thing going on.
Yeah. So signing up for Netflix is one of the first things I did when I got here. And I've been watching the Star Trek, and it looks pretty good. You know, it's a streaming service, and it's not as crisp as you would want. It kind of feels like an advertisement for this Blu-ray that LeVar is talking about, because you can see it, but you know, as you're watching it, you can notice that there's, you know, flaws here and there, and the quality of the streaming is not that great. It's about what you would have seen if you're watching on a, you know, standard def TV in the 80s and 90s. It made me really want to see a crisp, beautiful film transfer. LeVar used the hashtag, which... Are you watching this hashtag too? Mind blown.
Oh, of course. I mean, I actually have a third display over here on my desk just to monitor the hashtag mind blown. You never know what you're going to get at that hashtag.
Right.
Well, speaking of this, one more thing that came up. I was just checking today to see if there were any updates. Mm-hmm. And I did find one more update over on TrekNews.net that came from Digital Bits, again, I believe, of a few of the other episodes. You know, we've known that Encounter at Farpoint is getting some kind of remastering treatment as one of the test episodes. And two others were mentioned by name here. One of them is The Inner Light, which is, of course, one of the all-time favorites among Star Trek fans.
Right.
Where Picard lives the whole life in just a matter of a few minutes from the space probe.
Right.
And then Sins of the Father, you know, a Klingon episode.
Yep.
So if that's true, it looks like they're maybe kind of taking episodes at random from throughout the entire series and doing some tests to see perhaps the differences in the film stock, the digital effects that were done, so forth could be a reason for that.
Yeah, definitely. You know, there's really only one episode I'm excited about seeing remastered, and that's Shades of Grey. So if we can...
I know.
If we can get that one announced soon...
I think they're going to release that one as a standalone. I think it's Shades of Grey Remastered Director's Cut Platinum Edition.
Ooh.
It's going to be a three-disc set. It's going to have a disc two is the making of Shades of Grey. And disc three is just kind of handheld camera footage of the budget meeting that led to Shades of Grey.
I think so.
It's going to sell for $29.95. And... limited to 1,701 copies, I'm sure. So I already have it on pre-order with Amazon.
Indeed, indeed. Okay.
One other thing I wanted to get to here, talking about LeVar Burton.
Yes.
Obviously, he's good at digging up information and informing us about what's happening with Remastered. But another thing LeVar Burton is really good at is doing a barrel roll. And Tristan, who everyone knows as the host of Hyper Channel on Trek FM, Tristan sent me a link last night that kind of had me rolling on the floor in here.
Did you roll under something, Chris?
I did. I rolled under my desk. I did a barrel roll under my desk. This just cracked me up. It's JordyPickBarrel.ytmnd.com, and we'll put that link in the show notes. But someone has done a brilliant loop of Jordy doing a barrel roll under the blast door coming down. Did you watch this video?
Yeah. I mean, I'm a huge fan of these You're the Man Now Dog images where it's just a repeating gif of something really amusing. And Jordy likes to, I don't know, is it only Best of Both Worlds and Generations when he does this? I feel it was every other episode.
I don't know.
Jordy's rolling under
something.
I was
thinking about that. I was thinking, like, I have to go back and find out how many times he's done this, because it does feel like it's like a trademark Jordy move.
Yeah.
But it is Best of Both Worlds he does it, and he does it in the movie, in Generations, right?
In Generations.
When the ship is about to crash. And that one cracks me up because it's so staged, because he goes under the door, and then the way he stops, it's like... It's like,
right.
He, you know, like I can see LeVar saying, I really want this scene in here.
Oh, it's this, perfect.
This video and the music with it is just brilliant. We'll definitely have that link in the show notes.
Definitely.
All right. So another of our favorite TNG actors and actresses, Marina Sirtis, has a couple of news items going on right now.
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, a sad note that the Dancing with the Stars contestants, whatever the word is, they were announced, and I believe she was not part of the list this year.
Right, she was not.
Despite having quite a following.
Yeah, and I think I saw on the ABC website, they called them cast, which I find interesting. You know, it's like, so you think you can dance, they're contestants, obviously, trying to win something, but on Dancing with the Stars, they're the cast. It's, I don't know, sounds weird to me, but yeah, I was going to mention this to you because they did release who the cast members are, and I was kind of shocked that Marina was not selected when Nancy Grace is going to be on Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah.
Ricky Lake, and I just don't know that I would want to watch Nancy Grace or Ricky Lake
I don't recognize most of these names. You know, there's a Chiana Phillips.
Well,
I know Ethan Phillips.
Yeah. Well, no, Chiana Phillips is from the old Wilson Phillips group, the singing group.
Okay. Well, maybe she's famous to people other than me.
You're a little too young, I think, to know who she is. And of course there's Hope Solo, which is Han Solo's daughter.
I thought so.
Obviously, originating from the first episode of Star Wars, A New Hope. So you've got Hope Solo in there, and David Arquette. And I don't. It's an interesting cast. I mean, I don't know how they choose. I don't know what the criteria is here. I was disappointed.
And it's possible Marina's availability just wasn't there. So
maybe
many reasons.
Maybe she'll be on the next season. I was a little disappointed that she wasn't around, but. But we had a different story that was kind of the main little news story for Marina this week.
More that I want to talk about is this really exciting, I think, theater production that she's going to be in with Neil Patrick Harris. So they're doing A Snow White Christmas in North Hollywood and Cinderella Christmas as well. Which is, it looks really interesting. It's going to be sort of an updated musical thing. They're going to have like Lady Gaga songs, Michael Jackson songs. Does she sing? Is this something we knew about?
I'm not sure. They say that she's going to be playing the role of the Wicked Queen. Which, I don't know. Marina Sirtis doesn't strike me as a wicked or evil person, so maybe this will be a new stretch for her acting abilities.
I could see her doing it.
Yeah. Well, she was kind of a badass Romulan in the face of the enemy, right?
Ah, see, there you go.
Posing in the Tal Shiar. So, all right. Well, this is coming up. It's going to be running, December 22nd to January 8th, I believe
right.
It is. That's the one she's in, correct? And that's at the Share Forum Theater in Thousand Oaks.
Ah, right.
All right. We'll put more information about this on Trek FM. So just check the news blog and we'll have something up there as we get a little more information.
Yeah. And perhaps we could have friend of the show, Brian Finfter, go watch the show and let us know what he thought of it.
Good idea. Let's be sure to let Brian know about that. All right.
All right.
So what else do we have up in news today, Greg?
All right. Well, I was talking a little bit earlier about collectibles and toys and games, and I did see some fantastic Star Trek figures at the comic shop I visited today. And actually, I saw an Enterprise A little stand-up thing. It was maybe 5 or 6 inches long, and I almost bought it. It was about $20. I almost bought it. I'll probably buy it tomorrow.
Self-control for one day.
Exactly. But we have a story about more of these things coming out to try to extract more money from people like me, which I believe we talked a couple weeks ago about the Mego-style Mantrap toys and the Cage, some original series. And this will actually be next-gen. I believe there's a Borg and a Picard.
Yeah.
And they're sort of, they've got cloth costumes and they're sort of cartoony looking.
Yes, they are a bit. They are, well, they're interesting. They do have that kind of, Mego-esque feel to them. I remember having some figures like this when I was a kid. Not of Next Generation, of course, but of TOS and some other things. And I don't know about these. I'm kind of a fan of the more realistic figures myself.
Yeah.
I think the Picard figure here looks pretty good in the face, although he looks like he borrowed Riker's uniform. Because
that's the problem. His uniform just doesn't quite fit the top part. He looks like he needs to be pulling. I know he loves pulling it down.
Yeah.
He'll need to do quite a bit of that with this uniform.
Yeah, he does because, it's quite baggy on him.
Borg looks pretty good.
He's been at the gym working out, He's got big... built up his upper torso a bit more. So you like the Borg figure?
I think the Borg looks pretty good. It looks pretty detailed. He's got the eye patch. It looks like it could be one of the ones from Best of Both Worlds, although it looks like maybe it's one of the more detailed ones from later on.
Maybe.
I think it looks pretty good. I think that the sort of cartoony style lends itself well for working with the Borg, more so than with Picard.
Do you? Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's okay for me. Like you said, it's definitely one of the Borg from the TNG series. It's pre-First Contact Borg.
It's no 7 of 9.
It's no 7 of 9. I don't know. I'm not wild about this Borg myself. There's something about the face that just feel like it's like a, I feel like I'm at some kind of nightclub and or maybe it's like Kiss. It's kind of like, looks kind of like Kiss. In
sort
Borg
of a,
gear.
A cross between Borg and Claw.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, the makeup. Whoever did Claw's makeup in Star Trek V, they hired him to come in and do the face for this figure. But I don't know. You'll just have to see what you think about them. We'll put a link in the show notes and you can go check out these figures that are going to sell for around $20 a piece. And they're going to be in comic shops, specialty stores, and of course some online retailers. And if we didn't mention at the beginning of this story, this is Diamond Toys coming out with these. All right.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool. Now, even more cool than this is something we've been talking about. And actually, did we talk last week about Cryptic Studios being purchased by a Chinese MMO company? I don't think we actually mentioned it on the show.
I think we talked about it in between last week's show and this recording on Twitter a bit. Yeah.
Well, they sort of released an FAQ that said, oh, nothing's really going to change. We're basically going to have the same game. Don't worry about it, guys. And then the Chinese company put out a press release that said they're going to go free to play later this year.
Right.
So that's basically a complete change.
They let it leak during an earnings call. I think it was about a week ago before Cryptic could say anything.
And I think that's not a fan of that.
No. I'm sure they didn't think that it was going to get out, but of course.
Right.
I guess maybe it's one of these, you know, the internet in China things. Didn't yet realize that if you say anything anywhere, it's going to be on the internet in about 15 seconds. So, I mean, this show is already on the internet. Someone's listening to us right now, even before I do any editing. But anyway, it's been officially announced now that Star Trek Online is going free to play. And this is something that I think we all saw coming for quite some
definitely.
Time.
Yeah, definitely. We talked about this a while ago that like what they really need to do is go free to play, let you buy certain perks, which I guess you can continue to have your subscription and get some of these perks for free. But the idea is you'll just be able to download the client and play. And if you don't want to spend any money and you just want to play a basic game experience and actually earn things, you're still going to be able to, which I think is pretty awesome.
Yeah, it is great. It's going to be, I think, a real great move for Star Trek Online, and it's going to open up this game to so many more players. I know so many people who tell me that they want to play Star Trek Online, but it's just too much money. I mean, you have to buy the game, and then you have to pay monthly. And this way, not only are you going to be able to play each month at no charge, you're also going to be able to download the game now for free as well. So, so it really is free. The other thing they're doing is they're going to have two levels, and they're calling it Silver Players and Gold Members. And the Silver Players is the free version. And then Gold Members is going to be $14.99, which is the price of the basic membership anyway right now. That's what I've been paying for the past year or two, however long it's been. And I looked, there is a comparison chart of these features.
Yeah.
If you're interested in what they are. And we'll put a link to this in the show notes. But I looked at it, and what they're giving you for free, it's actually quite good. Just to hit on a couple of the differences here. For free, you get two character slots. And if you want three character slots, then you pay the $14.99. There are a few differences. Like you can have more inventory items. You can have some like your Captain Retrain tokens, a few things like that. Foundry Creator Access is something that's going to be available to gold members that's locked for free. But, you know, these are things that you kind of use them as you really, really get into the game. So if you're just curious about Star Trek Online, and even if you become kind of a moderate player of the game, you're going to be able to have pretty much everything that you want, I think, for free.
Yeah, which is great. I feel like there's been this barrier of that, you know, you have to buy the game, then spend $14.99, and it's just a little too much for a game that isn't blowing off the doors. You know, World of Warcraft was somehow big enough that everybody was just willing to pay. But basically everyone else has been having trouble getting into the market. It'll be interesting to see what Star Wars The Old Republic does when it launches. I don't remember when it launches, but I feel like they're going to have to go free to play eventually too when they realize that this market is just really tough to enter. And with this, I mean, the hardest thing for me is just going to be getting Windows on my computer so I can try it out.
Yeah, right.
But once I do that, I'm definitely going to play it.
Yeah, for sure. Is there another Star Wars game like this right now, or is Old Republic going to be the first dedicated Star Wars universe game?
There's Galaxies, which came out maybe 8 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that now.
And it was supposed to be, you know, the end-all Star Wars World of Warcraft killer. And everyone hated it, and then they rebooted it, and more people liked it, but it's still, if it's even limping along, it's not doing well. They may actually have shut down the servers by now.
I see. Because I was wondering, because I think that one of the factors in the timing anyway here of this is the fact that Star Trek Infinite Space is going to be launching soon, free to play. And I saw some recent footage from Infinite Space, and the game is really looking better and better.
Oh, nice.
Much better than what we had seen, you know, going back a few months ago or going back to E3. It looks like it could really give Star Trek Online a run for its money. And the fact that Infinite Space is set in the DS9 time period in the storyline of the Dominion War could attract a lot of fans that are really into that. So I think that's a big factor here. But this is exciting news anyway. And we're going to put several links in the show notes to information about this. So just hop over to the show page for this episode of The Ready Room and you'll find...
check out the F2P FAQ.
Yes.
As they termed it.
Great name. All right. Well, if flying through space gives you any kind of motion sickness, you need to go to sick bay. And as we talk about Trek technology on here sometimes and the efforts to create Star Trek technologies in real life, we have a new story that is out this week about British engineers who have built a 1 million pound Star Trek style sick bay for the National Health Service.
Now that's not how heavy it is. That's how much it costs.
That's right.
I believe.
That's 1 million sterling pounds.
So this looks really quite interesting. They build it with NASA, and the idea is it's sort of... I'm actually not quite sure what it is. It says it's supposed to be... it's out of a project for detecting the presence of life on Mars, but it ends up being sort of a sick bay that can sort of examine you and diagnose you without having to have a doctor, you know, do actual probing.
Yeah.
If I understand it correctly.
Right.
And sort of a lead into the tricorder, this sort of the mobile tricorder we talked about a few weeks ago.
Yeah, I think it's a lead into that and like the bio beds that you see in Star Trek, even going back to the original series. I think it's either this or it's the world's most expensive breathalyzer. Because it's made up of three sets of instruments. And what these instruments do is one of them analyzes a patient's breath. So if you have been drinking, it's going to be really hard for you to cover it up with this thing around. But the other one is it has a set of instruments that use visual imaging to examine a patient's skin. And then the third one monitors the inside of the body and measures blood flow and oxygenation in real time. And
it's sort of like the thing I had to step through as I was getting off the plane to make sure that I didn't have any weapons on me.
Right. Now, that raises an interesting question. If you use this sick bay, do you have to take your shoes off before this machine is able to find
please
out
take your
the
laptop
status
out of
your
the bag,
health?
Sir. Please put your laptop in the box, sir.
Please turn it on.
Sir, please take off your shoes, sir.
Yeah.
Stop thinking, sir. Just listen to me, sir.
Do anything I say. So this is, I take it, and I guess the Mars connection here and the technology that was developed for the Mars missions is kind of the ability of examining life signs without having to actually make contact with anything. And so in this case, without making contact with the patient, it would be able to gather this data from you, which would be great if you're like me and you don't like having needles and things stuck in you.
Yeah. It seems like it's sort of like with the Apollo missions, we got computers. It'd be great if from going to Mars, we got all sorts of these huge advances in medical technology because of government funding.
So do you like getting computers better than Velcro and Tang, or... what's your favorite thing that we've ever gotten from research for the space program?
That my favorite thing we've gotten is the film Apollo 18.
Okay.
In theaters now. I'm kidding. Do not go see Apollo 18.
And that is not a paid sponsorship, by the way.
No, it's not. It is the opposite paid sponsorship.
Oh, I know what it is. You're trying to get this movie pulled from theaters, aren't you?
Yes,
I am. It's kind of like the way you get TV shows canceled. Yes. It's the Eureka strategy. Only one weekend for Apollo 18. Apollo 18 pulled from theaters after opening weekend, thanks to Greg Harbin on The Ready Room.
I'll take my bow now.
Yeah. All right. Well, This will be, I think, an interesting long-term technology here anyway. I don't think it's anything that's going to give us Star Trek-type sick bays in the near term.
Yeah.
But I do think if we were to jump ahead, you know, 30, 40 years from now, we could have hospital rooms that strongly resemble the sick bays on Star Trek. I think that's very, very possible.
Yeah, I think it'd be great.
And maybe even more advanced than what has even been imagined in Star Trek.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll put in a link to this story in the show notes, because the actual article that we're talking about here provides a lot more background information, you know, to how this stuff works mm-hmm. from a scientific perspective.
Right. Right. And you're going to want to have a sick bay with imaging sensors to study a silicon-based alien life form, like in our next story.
Yes, this is another one of the science fiction or science fact stories from TrekNews.net that we talk about from time to time.
Yeah. I know you love to talk about the Horta, but there have been many things. The crystalline entity from Datalore, the Excalibion of Excalibia from the original series, the microbrain of Valara 3. There was a silicon-based parasite in Voyager, and then a silicon-based virus in Enterprise. I'm looking forward to what the next film has as far as silicon-based life forms. Perhaps a silicon-based nanovirus. Or
a silicon-based lens flare.
Ooh.
I don't know how you'd do that, but but if there's a way, JJ will find it.
We'll figure it out.
Hey, this would be a great poll for Trek FM, right? Which is your favorite silicon-based life form on Star Trek?
See if we can get the fan bases out for that one.
Yeah.
Team Horta. Team silicon-based virus.
Yeah, it's going to be Team silicon-based virus, because the Enterprise fan base is going to band together for that one.
All right.
Yeah, so...
So are silicon-based life forms possible? I guess that's what this article is asking. And it says that possibly. It says that silicon compounds can potentially carry some form of coded information similar to DNA, but it's not quite as good as organic matter.
Right.
But just because it's not as good doesn't mean it's not possible.
Right. It's this is something that I've, you know, read speculation on here and there over the years in many places, and it seems, I guess, that silicon is probably the second best to carbon in terms of being the basis for life and being able to. Mm-hmm. To have the building blocks of life. But like you said, it's not quite as good as carbon. So I guess my feeling on it is probably that somewhere in the universe, there's got to be some life that's based on silicon,
yeah.
if it's possible. Whether or not that life can advance in terms of intelligence the way we have being based on carbon, who knows? It seems like it might be a little more difficult, but probably by no means impossible.
Yeah. But this article is really interesting and goes into much more detail than we can on the podcast. So definitely worth checking out if you're at all interested in this sort of in-depth scientific analysis of Star Trek.
Yeah, absolutely. And there'll be a link to that in the show notes as well, and you can delve into the science. And Greg, mentioning Trek FM polls there, we ran a poll. We're kind of behind on delivering results on this one. We just had a lot of stuff going on the past week or so, and we haven't gotten to this one yet, but we had this great poll, which was, which villain's name do you want to shout in battle? And
yes.
This was a popular poll, and we got a lot of responses and quite a few write-in votes for this one as well. And I thought I would just deliver the results here. Before I do that, what was your selection for the villain whose name you most want to shout in battle?
Well, mainly just because I would like to meet her, even if it's only in battle, I had to pick Empress Hoshi.
Yes, I also voted for Empress Hoshi here. and a lot of people voted for Empress Hoshi because there was a team Empress Hoshi and hashtag Empress Hoshi. And, as you would probably expect, the winner of the poll with 37% of the vote was Khan!
Of course.
And number two with 31% of the vote was Empress Hoshi. trailing.
They got a huge percentage, like just them together. Most people went one way or the other.
That's right. They were by far the two choices. Following them, and the only other choice that had double-digit votes was 11%, surprisingly, for Lore.
Oh, nice. Lore getting some love or hate or whatever it is.
And after Lore, the next highest vote getter was actually a write-in vote, and this was for Kang, the Klingon. And
that's a good one.
After that, everyone else had 2% of the vote. We have quite a few people here with 2% of the vote. Choices that were on the poll itself were Nero, Lens Flare, Wayoon, and Well Probe. They all got 2% of the vote.
What did people write in?
And we had 4 write-in votes with 2% of the vote, and those were Harcourt Fenton Mudd, Q, J.J. Abrams.
That's the Gorn captain, yeah, his friends.
That's the Gorn captain, I know. And Gnord. So those were the write-in votes.
Digging deep there.
Yeah, so thank you everyone who voted in the poll. And
definitely.
Our current poll, which may still be running by the time this episode airs, is which villain is most likely to overthrow the Federation in the future?
Right. You have in there, I think, like the Romulans and the Klingons and the Borg.
Yes, and the Tribbles are in there. And
of course.
The Tribbles have gotten quite a few votes. And I don't think you'll be surprised to know that J.J. Abrams has already received votes in this poll as well.
Oh, heavens.
Okay. Well, before we close out news, we would be remiss if we did not just mention the 45th anniversary of Star Trek real quick. And StarTrek.com has been teaming up with the remaining TOS actors who are still with us to answer a series of questions about the Star Trek franchise in general. And they're asking one question per day between now when we record this, which is on Thursday, and Saturday. So over the course of a few days, some questions to the actors. And Greg, what are the questions they're asking here?
Let's see. So the first question was, who was Star Trek's unsung hero? The person who rarely gets his or her due for helping to make Star Trek a legendary franchise. So who do you think here had the best answer or something you definitely agreed with or hadn't thought about?
Well, let's see. Nichelle Nichols and Leonard Nimoy, William Shatner, George Takei, and Walter Koenig all answered here. And that's a really good question. Walter Koenig puts a lot of the praise onto Nick Meyer and his writing, which I think was quite important in the movie franchise.
Yeah, definitely. I'm not sure if he's too much an unsung hero. I think
that's true.
Mentioned Nicholas Meyer basically every time I talk about the Star Trek films. He's without him, we wouldn't have Wrath of Khan or Star Trek VI.
Right.
And probably not the rest of them either. He was a huge part of what made it work.
And possibly not The Next Generation and Deep Space Nine and everything else either.
Right,
because
right.
The success of those movies really helped fuel the rebirth of Star Trek in the first place. I think Bob Justman and Gene Kuhn, as both Leonard Nimoy and William Shatner mentioned, are probably the unsung heroes behind Star Trek in its early years, for sure, anyway.
Yeah, definitely. People tend to think that Gene Roddenberry was doing everything on his own. And, you know, for the most part, he was. He did a lot of rewrites. He did a lot of late nights in the editing room. But Bob Justman and Gene Kuhn were definitely there doing, you know, at least as much work as he was to make the show happen. So it's glad to see them getting a little bit of mention here.
Definitely so. The second question that they asked in part two was, who, in your opinion, was the best or most important director and or guest star on either the original series or in one of the original series movies? What did you think about the answers here?
Yeah, so I don't know the directors on the original series as well as I've paid attention to them on Next Gen and Voyager. So obviously Shatner said Nick Meyer, because just as far as the movies, he's probably the best director they had. Nimoy, of course, was quite good on 3 and 4. But as far as the episodes, people seem to say Mark Daniels and Joe Pevney. I'm not sure which of the episodes they did, but it sounds like they did most of the episodes. So they probably got to know the cast quite well and were able to pump out those shows from week to week.
Yeah. I'm going to go with the guest star route myself here, and I think I have to go with Ricardo Montalban, which is who Nichelle Nichols mentioned. Just both in Space Seed and then, of course, in The Wrath of Khan, very few guest stars have had the presence on the screen that Montalban had and have meant so much to Star Trek fans over the years.
Yeah, he was just fantastic. Yeah. I just found out that he was going to be in Kill Bill and then wasn't at the last minute. And that really killed me because I love Ricardo Montalban, and to see him in one of my other favorite things would have been even better.
Yeah. So, well, you can always go pick up the DVDs of Fantasy Island.
I have to see if it's on Netflix Instant Watch.
It probably is. You can check that out. All right. Well,
The plane.
That's right. Even my kids know that. So, as we record this, only three parts of this StarTrek.com feature have been posted. So the third one that we have is, what's your most enduring Gene Roddenberry anecdote?
Yeah, and it's an interesting one. Some interesting stories in here. I wanted to mention especially what Leonard Nimoy said, which I just mentioned before, that he would often just take a script that came in and rework it and just turn it into a good show. Later on, Ronald D. Moore would do the same thing on DS9 and also Battlestar. Whereas, you know, you hire a writer to do it and he does a good job, but sometimes they just don't know the show as well as you do, and you can just do a pass and just turn it into Star Trek, sort of in the way that Stuart Baird turned Nemesis into not Star Trek. Gene Roddenberry could do the reverse.
That's right. That's a good point. And that's what Leonard Nimoy said here, right, in response to this. So there's going to be a few more of these over the next few days after we record this. Mm. So visit the show page for this episode of The Ready Room, and we'll put links to all of these, and we'll have a news item up as well. And you can hop over and read the responses from everybody. It's really a great thing that StarTrek.com has put together here. And it's wonderful on the 45th anniversary to hear these candid thoughts from original series actors who we still have with us. When The Next Generation premiered in 1987, it was kind of an uncertain thing. Fans of the original series weren't all that keen on the idea of a new Star Trek, and I think even the studio wasn't sure that it was going to succeed. And after a rocky first season and a kind of budget-stressed second season, the show got its sea legs in the third and finally led up to the finale, The Best of Both Worlds, and that's what we're going to talk about today. And of course, I have Greg here with me, and we also have friend of the show, Brian Finifter, with us today.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me back.
Thanks for joining us again. So, I remember watching Best of Both Worlds in first run and being one of those fans who spent the entire summer of 1990 wondering if Riker was the new lead.
Right.
And Shelby was going to be the first officer, and Picard Stewart was out of his contract and all this stuff. So, you have any memories of that?
I don't remember this episode airing. I remember that it did air, and I remember seeing it many times, you know, in syndication afterwards. But I was surprised to hear that there was so much fan uproar over the summer. Do you remember that much, Brian?
No, I don't remember watching this on its first run. I remember watching Star Trek: The Next Generation from about season 5 or 4 or 5 on, but I don't remember watching Best of Both Worlds. when it was first on. Obviously, I saw it many times in syndication, but yeah.
Oh, wow. There was nothing like seeing this the first time.
I bet.
These days, you know, we're so used to having DVDs, and when we have cliffhangers, we just pop in the second part and we just watch it. And but it was really, I do remember very clearly watching this episode and Riker saying fire, and the screen goes black and it says to be continued, and you're like, damn you, to be continued. You know, what are you doing to me? Because there hadn't been any cliffhangers before this.
And that great, like, dolly around his face zoom in. One of the great camera moves of all time.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. It was great. And the music building up. And it was beautifully done. And it was, you know, there hadn't been any cliffhangers in Star Trek before this. Mm-hmm. And so you weren't expecting it. And I guess you got caught up in the story, too. And maybe you didn't realize that 44 minutes had gone by.
Yeah.
And the episode has to end here. And so it really did kind of catch you, like, to be continued. And really spent the whole summer just wondering what was going on.
Yeah. And I think part of what led into that was something that I was surprised by rewatching it, was that this really was a Riker episode. You know, we remember that Picard becomes Locutus. And we remember, especially First Contact, where it's all about Picard and Data. In this one, you know, Data's hardly in it, and Picard leaves, I don't know, midway through. And even before Picard's gone, it's all about Riker. And, you know, is Riker going to leave the ship? Is he going to get along with this Borg expert that they brought on? And all this stuff. It's Riker, Riker, Riker. I don't know if the show ever is this much Riker, except in possibly Shades of Grey.
Shades of Grey, yeah. A lot of Riker in there. There are a few like second chances where it's Riker, you know, in his split. But it's true. This was a Riker episode, and the rest of the cast is kind of grasping for things to do here. You know, like Beverly goes over so she can fire the phaser on the Borg ship, and Geordi does a barrel roll under the door. You know, it's like, got to get attention here. But this was a Riker episode, and they did a great job of making you think that the whole story was a setup to Riker becoming the captain.
Yeah, they sold it, and I've heard that there were rumors that Patrick Stewart was going to leave the show, that his contract was up, and I've also heard that those rumors were deliberately planted as part of some kind of master three-dimensional chess of creating suspense. I don't know if I quite believe that, but nevertheless, the rumors were floating around there, and however they came about, it's just that kind of thing. Adds a level of suspense that you can't, that you don't normally get, that you can't normally orchestrate. So, on every level, they were firing.
Yeah.
And they also put out a fake script for part two of this on the internet
to
throw off fans. And in there, Picard comes back, and the whole assimilation thing was some kind of practical joke played by Q. And they had like really, really guarded the script over the summer. They forbade the cast and crew from talking about the storyline to anybody, including the families. And they put out some misinformation because the fan base obviously was trying to get their hands on it. And this was in 1987. You know, it's not like today, where everyone is, you know, feverishly searching for any information like this, and it's all over the internet, and you can't keep anything because you got Trekkie leaks going. And and you can't hide anything. But even in 87, I mean, this was really like, we've got to find out what happens to Picard.
Well, they've done such a good job in part one of building up the suspense and the tension. The writer of the episode, I believe it was Michael Piller.
Yeah, it was.
He was actually thinking of, leaving the show at the time. And what he was saying in some interviews I was reading was that he was having sort of the same thoughts Riker that he gave to Riker of, why am I still here? You know, I worked so hard to make it on Star Trek, but now I want to do my own thing. And why am I sticking with Star Trek? What is it that keeps me here? So he was able to put himself into Riker. And he was also at the same time trying to build up this big cliffhanger. I wonder what led them to want to have a cliffhanger, if that was just what came out of breaking the episode, or if that sort of came down from the network, that they wanted to have a big cliffhanger because maybe people were starting to get less interested in the show.
I don't know there. The exact reason. I mean, reasons I can think of is that interest was building. Fans were kind of starting to come around. Mm-hmm. And The Next Generation, you know, the third season is kind of viewed as an ongoing maturity of The Next Generation and it turning into a great show. And, you know, what better way to build anticipation for the fourth season than to have a cliffhanger? Because, I mean, second season, what more could they have possibly done to kill any anticipation for a third season than to have Shades of Grey as the season finale?
Right.
And it's the exact opposite at the end of the third season by having this cliffhanger, which not only is it a cliffhanger, but it's a great story. It's a great cliffhanger.
Now, to be fair, Shades of Grey is a terrible, terrible episode. But as you mentioned, they had the budgetary issues in season two. But they were also dealing with the writer's strike at the time. So that, I think, more than anything, played a big role in Shades of Grey's existence and creation, unfortunately.
And also, I should interject here that that writer's strike, Greg has also blamed it for the poor quality of Star Trek V.
Yes, I have.
Which I'm not buying.
Well, I have heard Shatner say, I think it was in the... in the captain's documentary, I don't remember, but Shatner did mention recently something along those lines of how the writer's strike hurt Star Trek V. How much better it would have been without the writer's strike, that's debatable, but
The question. But yeah, you make a good point that as much as we like to dog on Shades of Grey, there was a writer's strike going on, as well as severe budgetary issues. I think they were pretty much out of money by the end of second season. So,
which is interesting because they were actually given extra money for this episode. They were able to go to the network and say, you know, we're doing this big Borg episode. Can we have money? And the network actually said, yes, sure. Really blow it out, which is great because, you know, I think they tried to do the Borg a few times over the course of season three, and they could never quite figure out a way to do it. And I think what they needed was money, and they needed a big emotional push. And making it be the finale and having it be a cliffhanger was that hook they needed to really bring the Borg on strong.
Yeah, they talk about they were trying to find ways to bring the Borg back through season three after they had introduced them in Q Who in season two, and like they were trying to figure out the personality for the Borg and how, you know, a hook as to how the characters could relate to them, and I think the way it ended up working out was the best way. I think the scariest villain of all is this like force of nature that doesn't really have any regard for you as a character in any way, shape, or form. It's just gonna roll right over you like a hurricane. But to really do that kind of conflict, that kind of story right, it takes the right scale to do it. So eventually they were able to do that with the Borg, but it took that kind of those special circumstances and then a little bit of extra cash for them to be able to pull it off the right way.
It was interesting that Pillar sort of ran into the same problem that Moore and Braga did when writing First Contact, where it's hard to have a show or a movie where your villain is an unstoppable force.
Right.
And the Borg even say, you know, to come up against you, we need to have a face for you to look at and have an emotional connection to. Which apparently First Contact retconned it so there was a Borg queen on that ship.
Right.
But I don't know why she didn't just talk to them. But what do you think, especially Chris and Brian, what do you think of the idea of having Picard become a Borg? Does that work for you on a conceptual level?
Dramatically, yeah, absolutely it does, because it's such a betrayal. It's not quite the right word, but it's just an emotional kick to the gut. Mm-hmm. Of here is the authority figure that you put all of your trust and confidence into, and it's just swiped and reversed on you. You know, When you're creating drama, when you're telling stories, you're always looking for the reversal, how to take the circumstances and pivot them and turn them on their head in a really emotionally charging way. And one of the great ones in television, I think, is taking the captain of the Enterprise, the captain of the flagship of the fleet, and turning him into the villain just like that. It's one of the great dramatic reversals in Star Trek, and I think in all of television. If you really think about it, it's... in terms of the in-universe concept, well, not really. Do the Borg really care about having that interface? Yeah. Does it really gain them anything? Is it really efficient from their point of view? Maybe not, but I'll give them the cheat for the sake of the drama.
Yeah. You know, I'll give it to him just for the scene where Riker goes up to try to stop the Borg on the bridge and just gets thrown like 30 feet up the ramp.
I tell
ramp.
You, they do yeah. play it the right way in the sense that they by taking Picard, by abducting him and turning him, it does have a very palpable effect on both Riker and on the rest of the crew. But we see its effect on, you know, Riker's confidence and his ability to step up and do what's necessary is really hindered by the fact that he can't let go of Picard. So it could have very easily, and I think later on in later incarnations of the Borg on Star Trek, it could very easily have been, oh, this is just kind of an excuse to have a character that we can talk to. Yeah. But it serves a story function greater than that. And the way they make it play, you can see the Borg, you can see what the Borg are trying to do and that they're somewhat successful at doing it.
Yeah, yeah. It reminds me of the beginning of season 2 of Battlestar when, Adama. When Adama is injured and other people kind of have to step up and be the captain. You know, there's no way you could really have Picard leave Riker for any legitimate reason.
Right.
And Riker was never going to leave and become his own captain. Like you say, it's sort of a cheat, but I'll give it to him because it allows us to see how these characters deal with losing Picard.
Well, for me too, another thing in this particular instance of Picard being assimilated is that his assimilation added a depth to his character that was then continued for the rest of the next generation. At the end of this episode, one thing that happens with the score is that they show the Enterprise in orbit of Earth, moons in the background, but the dissonance, it doesn't end. It just leaves you hanging. There's a very dissonant chord that just tapers off, and it's, you know, saying that everything's not okay. You know, we destroyed the Borg cube, Picard is back, but this is going to leave scars for Picard, and this is going to change the crew. And you actually see that, and it instills a kind of a facet to Picard's character that makes him, I think, more serious or more pensive or things as you go on. And you don't see that, like Brian said, in later uses of the Borg, like in, I think it's Dark Frontier and Voyager, when you get Janeway and you get Tuvok and you get B'Elanna all assimilated. But after they're not Borg anymore, there's no residual effect on their character that they were Borg. It was just like, I'm going to dress up as a Borg and I'm going to do this away mission. I'm going to come back and I'm going to get in my regular clothes again and everything's going to be fine. And it was just a gimmick. But here it was a turning point for the show and for Picard's character and other characters. So it worked great.
Yeah. I mean, it's a direct setup for another one of the greatest episodes of Star Trek immediately following, which is Family, which is, you know, showing Picard really trying to come to grips with this horrific, abduction and rape, really. I mean, what he's dealing with is rape. And returning to his family to try to deal with that. Best of Both Worlds is amazing because it's uncharacteristically so of Star Trek, at least. It's so great because it's really dealing with characters and conflict and these characters dealing with real issues, with real personal demons, whether it's Riker having this like crisis of self-confidence, which is just amazing, just to have this very confident character, you know, in the serial TV show where every story is about the adventure of defeating the space anomaly of the week. Riker is a very brash and self-confident man. And then in this episode, we really see some depth and a different layer to that character. And then we do something equally as great for Picard as well, and set up later depth for him later on.
Yeah. So how about Commander Shelby? Obviously, her and Riker had this ongoing bickering, which I kept expecting to turn into sexual tension, and it just never happened. They were
which
really
is surprising with Riker, right?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
they were really playing like the two of them just were at loggerheads all through it. She never made a suggestion that he liked. It sort of goes against Gene's. This is as Gene was sort of becoming less involved in Star Trek. It sort of goes against his idea of not wanting to have Federation people arguing. You never would have seen something like this in the first season, where you have two officers arguing just over and over and over again.
Yeah, which I love. We talked about it. Was it on the Deep Space Nine episode where it's just a it's showing a different idea of utopia than we generally think of. Gene Roddenberry's idea of utopia was kind of everybody is really pretty and gets along all the time, no matter what. But that's not necessarily the only definition of utopia. And I like the idea that we see a glimpse of here and that we see more in Deep Space Nine of like, well, everybody has the basic needs taken care of. Nobody's going to starve or go cold or go hungry. But that doesn't necessarily mean you're not going to have your heart broken or you're going to get along with everybody you work with. And so I love that idea of a utopia that, you know, just we may be human beings who have figured everything out, or at least societally and technologically have figured most things out. But that doesn't necessarily mean we figured out how to get along with that person at work that just bugs the crap out of you. And I love seeing that dynamic in Best of Both Worlds.
I think I would have liked to see Picard step up a little bit more in before he becomes the cutest, and I don't know, be a sort of mediator between the two of them. He sort of lets I'm reminded of the scene where in Emissary not Emissary, it's the one where Odo's being accused of murder.
Oh yeah,
A Man Alone.
Right.
Which you always call A Man Apart.
I like it. A Man Apart. It's the lost Star Trek episode. Anyway.
Original title.
In A Man Alone, Kira goes over Sisko's head. And the Admiral like immediately tells Sisko, like, I don't know what she's doing. Don't ever let this happen again. And Picard doesn't really do that.
Get your person in line. Yeah.
Yeah. Picard sort of says, oh, that's a really good idea. Riker, don't you think that was a good idea she had? And I think he should have been a little bit more, you know, I don't listen to ideas that didn't come through my first officer. That's why I have a first officer.
I think personally...
Yeah, but remember...
I think personally watching that, having just watched that scene again, I think Picard knows exactly what he's doing in the sense that he's kind of setting up to ask Riker, what are you still doing here? Why aren't you taking these commands and just approaching it from a slightly different angle in the way Picard tends to do?
Yeah, that's what was. You have to remember that Shelby thought that Riker was leaving to take command of his own ship, and she thought she was auditioning for the position of first officer, and Picard also. Because Admiral Hansen was asking Picard why, you know, maybe Riker needs a kick in the pants. I think Picard was allowing this to go on to kind of make Riker look at himself and take care of himself and decide if he's going to go take a captaincy or he wants to stay here. So
it definitely makes sense.
So character of Shelby for me, I don't really like this. I never really liked this character very much, although... I think that Elizabeth Dennehy, who played Shelby, did an excellent job playing the role. I think she played the character just how that character needed to be played in this episode and creating this very abrasive relationship with Riker. And Shelby has gone on to be kind of a popular character, kind of surprising to me over the years, that Peter David picked Shelby up in the New Frontier book series as the first officer of the Excalibur. And I think in that series now that she is actually the captain of the ship. So she has endured in Star Trek long beyond this one appearance that she made in the Next Generation.
Yeah, I like the idea of Commander Shelby. I don't necessarily I don't know. It's a tough line, I guess, because I actually hate watching Commander Shelby, but you're supposed to hate yes. watching her. Right. So I don't know how much of it is, you know, and Elizabeth Dennehy really doing her job right, and how much of it is just I don't enjoy it. But then again, her dad is Brian Dennehy, who is another actor who I just don't enjoy watching at all. So maybe it's just something that runs in the family. Yeah,
runs in the family.
She did say that she had trouble with the technobabble in part one. Not much in part two, but I was noticing.
She couldn't tech the tech, huh?
Yeah. You know, we have to separate the saucer section.
And the subspace. The subspace kind of, yeah. And which, it's tough. I mean, right. it's from an actor's standpoint, she describes it, and many other actors describe it the same way, as it's literally a foreign language. It's something you have to learn kind of phonetically and just... Yeah. You know, like the Chinese in Firefly, it's just like you just learn it phonetically and you just say it with as much conviction as you can muster and hope nobody notices, which,
right.
And it's when you're dealing on, you know, TV schedules and TV timelines, it's very accelerated. You just show up and, you know, maybe you get cast on Tuesday and you're on set on Wednesday or Thursday for a 14 hour day and you got to do it.
Yeah.
So it can be tough. It can be very tough.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, while we're talking about minor characters, I wanted to ask you one question. Did anyone notice that Will Wheaton was like really mopey in part one for like no reason?
I don't know, mopey.
In the poker scene?
Well, I think it was...
He was like...
I think it's just a matter of...
Oh, in the poker scene, you know.
Wesley is the kid, so he's got to get his comeuppance every time.
Yeah.
So every time we see him, it's like, oh, well, it's the poker scene, so... Oh, we show that Wesley doesn't know anything. He still has to become a man. Okay. Or later, when they're in engineering and everybody's really tired. So we have to show that they're really tired, so we'll make the kid the most tired. And then, oh, when we have to make a heroic sacrifice where we're going to, you know, slam ourselves into the enemy ship, we have to show somebody have that look of horror on their face. Well, obviously, it's going to be Wesley. Right. I mean, I think it's just, it's an unfortunate, it's kind of like the Worf effect, but... A related, you know, a parallel to the Worf effect, which is, you know, if you have, you know, your villain of the week comes in and you have to show the audience how powerful your villain of the week is and how dangerous they are. So what's the best way to do that? Well, you have the villain of the week beat the crap out of the strong guy on your cast, which in the case of Next Generation is Worf. The problem is when you do that week after week after and week, then, really you're only showing how much of a pussy, your supposedly strong guy character is. I think it's kind of a similar thing.
Yeah, I think somebody said on Twitter, I don't even know why Worf tries to open doors. We all know Data's going to do it.
That's right. I saw that. And, you know, they did the same thing on Deep Space Nine with the Jim Hadar in By Inferno's Light, I think it was, one where they're on the asteroid prison and the Jim Hadar beating up the Klingons, beating up Worf, like to show how strong the Jim Hadar are.
I don't think that actually exactly qualifies, because that is over a period of time and Worf is really holding his own for a period of time. So it's...
That's true.
Yeah, anyway.
That's true. In this case about Wesley, but it's like that in the poker game. But then when they actually go into battle, they put Wesley at the con.
I know.
So it's like, here's the kid, you know, he doesn't know anything yet. He can't play poker. He's tired. He's mopey. But we're battling the greatest threat that the Federation has ever known. And we're the only ship standing in between the Borg and Earth. Let's put the kid
at the acting
con.
Ensign who hasn't even been to the academy yet.
Yeah, there's like no better qualified officer on the ship that can fly the ship at that moment in time.
He's an acting ensign, but the Traveler said that he was special. So that's like a rank and a half worth.
Maybe.
Of experience.
Put him like lieutenant commander, maybe. He's very special. That's right. All right. While we're talking so much about the Borg here, one thing that catches my eye in The Best of Both Worlds is that how they're able to make this one single Borg cube and these rather bland-looking Borg drones that come onto the Enterprise so incredibly menacing. When later on, when you start to get into Voyager, it's like Voyager's flying around with 20 Borg cubes and the crew regularly beams over to Borg ships and, you know, has Borg tea with them and makes plans and all kinds of stuff that goes on. And yet here we have one single Borg cube, and Admiral Hansen says that the Klingons are sending ships, and we've even thought about opening communication with the Romulans. And this is to stop one single Borg cube that is heading towards Earth. And at this point in time, the Borg are so menacing and powerful, and you feel that as a viewer, and how they are just defanged over the course of Voyager mainly, while the visuals get bigger and bigger and bigger in Voyager, but yet the threat gets smaller and smaller and smaller.
That's true. I mean, in First Contact, it was only one cube, and it, you know, got all the way to Earth and blew up a lot of ships, but that was not really the norm, especially once Voyager gets a hold of the Borg, and she can hold her own against like five or six of them at a time.
Yeah, it's definitely a case of what's called flanderization with your enemy. You're cranking it up, you know, every week you have to top last week's episode, so you're just cranking it up over and over and over again. And the producers of Voyager knew that, you know, the Borg were a fan favorite. So, you know, every time they were, you know, needed a strong week, they knew what well to go into, and then they just went into it too often. It's one of those things. It's, you have to know, you know, a lot of doing something well is in knowing when to pull back or when to hold back and do something just a little bit and not overdo it. And the Borg are absolutely that case. And I honestly think for as great of villains as the Borg are, and as amazing of an episode of a pair of episodes as Best of Both Worlds is, I really do think the Borg weakening happens even in the in Next Generation. When Lore teams up with them, it's like, okay, well,
That's
and then
true.
First Contact is, while being a decently solid film, at least entertaining film, adding the Queen to it takes away from the concept of the Borg, and their interest in Data takes away from their menace that existed in Best of Both Worlds. So I will agree that Voyager absolutely really ran it into the ground, but unfortunately, I think the Borg, at their strongest, unfortunately, became a well that was tapped too often, even in Next Generation.
That's true. But I guess the thing is that when you use the Borg so frequently, like Voyager did, they have to become inferior to our heroes, because you can't have them recurring and have them be that strong, because you can't kill off your characters or destroy the ship or anything along those lines. And the Borg, I think, like you said, they're so menacing. They seem to be a villain that can only be used in rare instances if you want to maintain the type of menace that we have in Best of Both Worlds, because if you use them very often, you have to start developing them. They can't be that, like, mysterious.
Well, it's just they're set up menace as an unstoppable villain, and it's, you can only stop your unstoppable villain so long before they're not unstoppable anymore. And so you can give it to them, you know, you can give it to them in QQ, obviously, because they don't really stop them, they just escape. You can give it to them in Best of Both Worlds because it's a great cliffhanger that works solidly, and, you know, it's a little bit of luck, and it's the Enterprise, so they're the best of the best. But you go to the, like I said, you go to that well too often, then you're fundamentally redefining what the concept is, and it's a law of diminishing returns. The more you go to it, the less you get out of it each time. And that's why you really need a really developed sense of self-restraint to do it only when you can really, really do it well. And unfortunately, that's one thing the producers of Voyager definitely did not have.
Yeah, I mean, even in Best of Both Worlds, they kept running away and managing to get away from the Borg.
Yeah, it was as much about them hiding and surviving to the next act, to the next commercial break, as anything else.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I really want to point out some great strategy by Picard, sending them back in time and going into V'ger's cloud from the motion picture in order to
hide actually from the it's the same effect as the Mutara Nebula from Wrath of Khan, if you look at it.
Oh, is it the same one?
It was a very smart move. That is the real Picard maneuver right there. Very smart.
I also want to point out,
but of course we know that the Borg can time travel themselves.
Yeah, which opens up the whole can of worms of any time travel story of, well, if you go back in time but you fail in your plan, then why don't you just go back in time again? But let's just not even go there. I do want to point out something that I didn't realize until recently. Admiral Hansen is played by George Murdoch, who is the same guy that played God in Star Trek V.
Yeah. He's God. Yeah.
Which I didn't even realize.
Even though we just watched it last week, I don't see it.
You don't?
Know.
Oh, I see it. Well, you know, I hear that in the next release of Star Trek V, they're going to bring in George Lucas, and he's going to put Admiral Hansen's face in front of Cybok on the planet there.
And it'll be as good as the rest of the film.
They could just have David Warner play this guy, too. They keep bringing him back.
The Admiral who stands around and smokes a lot, right? All right. So, well, what about The Best of Both Worlds as a turning point for the franchise itself? How do you see this particular episode? If you look at all the episodes of Star Trek, going back from the original series to the final episode of Enterprise, this particular episode as being like a very, very key moment in time for the Star Trek franchise.
Yeah, I definitely think this is the moment where Star Trek: The Next Generation really found its legs, and it found its it became its own show. At least it finished the process of really becoming its own show. There's another phrase in television parlance called growing the beard, which is where, you know, season one of a television show is really bad, and then, you know, season two is probably almost as bad, and Star Trek: The Next Generation is a very clear example of that. And
and so Riker was the manifestation.
Yeah,
of this,
Riker's
right?
beard, like as the beard. Parlance goes.
That's why he grew a beard.
Yeah, as the parlance goes, you know, when you grow the beard, which is a reference to Jonathan Frakes growing his beard for the second season, that's the show kind of growing up and finding its legs and finding its own stride. And I think season two is the process of Next Generation finding its legs, and then season three is it really settling on its own identity and something distinct and apart from the original series. And I think seasons three and four, I think, are probably the strongest seasons of Next Generation.
Yeah, the writers talked about that scene where the flesh color removing probe goes into Picard's head and turns him gray as sort of being, in their mind, the pivotal moment for Picard, where he stops being the Picard from early on and becomes this new Picard. And I think it's at sort of the same time that Patrick Stewart was starting to accept being humorous on set. I read an anecdote where he was in full Borg makeup and doing a rehearsal of the scene where he introduces himself to Riker and the others on the bridge. He walks up and says, now I've forgotten the quote. But he says something very
amusing. He says, I am Locutus of Borg. Have you thought about buying a Pontiac? And cracked
Thank
everyone
you.
Up. Yeah. I just read the same one. We're reading memoryalpha.org, which is a great resource.
Yes.
But if you go back to our discussion about the captain's commentary, we talked about how early on, or in the documentary, Patrick Stewart talks early on about how he was very serious and he didn't want any fooling around, and he was trying to take a kind of a captain's point of view of commanding the other main cast members. So when they were fooling around, he was like, stop, don't fool around, this is very serious business, and how they still don't let him live it down to this day. So yeah, in terms of, you know, the cast kind of finding their chemistry together, I think by Best of Both Worlds, they definitely found that as well.
Yeah, and the rhythm of the editing was getting a lot better. I remember specifically one cut where Picard's talking to, or Riker's talking to Picard, and immediately it just cuts to Riker talking to Troy. And basically it's a continuation of the conversation. Mm. And it's like, we're just following Riker's train of thought from one meeting to another. It doesn't feel as sometimes Star Trek can sort of end a scene.
Yeah.
And then now we're going to start a new scene.
Very theatrical, like, stagey and very contrived. And and to be fair, it definitely falls back into that plenty of times later on. But when you get this just real, this like smoothness of an emotional experience of, and I think Best of Both Worlds, particularly the part one, is remarkable in the sense of the focus that it has, in the sense of like you guys were saying earlier, this is definitely Riker's story. It is all about Riker and his point of view and his decision that he has to make about what kind of person he's going to be. And I mean, really, that's what what stories are about, is here's a human being, here's how they have to decide what kind of human being they're going to be, and here's an imaginary situation for them to work that out. And Star Trek, a lot of the times, isn't that, or at least it isn't that very well, necessarily. But I think Best of Both Worlds is one of the really finer examples of that in Star Trek, because it's all, everything, especially in part one, every scene and every moment is about Riker and what he's going through and what decisions he's going to make.
Yeah. And so then could we talk a little bit about how part two is kind of a letdown? It's not quite to the level of part one. And I don't know if it's because they were sort of, they wrote themselves into a corner and didn't quite know what to do. You had this big, huge moment of, you know, fire, the tech deflector beam thing. And then it does nothing at all. And then they sort of get Picard and they figure out a fancy way of making the Borg cube self-destruct. And it's sort of, it was more like what the Borg episodes were in the future and not as much an examination of the characters.
Yeah, it's always easier to write a great setup than it is to write a great payoff. Pulling a great payoff off is always tough to do. And as we talked about earlier, Michael Piller, who wrote part one, at the point he wrote part one, didn't know and thought that he probably wasn't going to come back to the show and have to write part two. So he did what all great writers do and what all writers should do, which is really write your characters into a corner so bad you as the writer, you have no idea how they're going to get out of the predicament they're in. And a lot of times as a writer, you pull back from that because you know at some point you have to get them out of it. But he talks about the fact that, you know, when he sat down to write episode one, he didn't think he was going to have to write episode two. So he really had a sense of freedom about, I can really, really screw these guys over and I don't have to worry about it. I don't have to clean up the mess later on. And I think that's a big reason why part one is as great as it is. Of course, he ended up coming back to the show, staying on the show and having to write part two. But
there was another example of that recently where a showrunner was convinced he was going to be fired over the summer. And he just wrote a horrible, impossible to get out of cliffhanger. And then he ended up having to stay on and figure out how to get them out of
it. Well, I'm sure it's happened. Maybe
that's what that was.
Maybe
who,
Frank
who
Darabont.
Who have you talked about on this show?
Well,
yeah,
we'll see. I guess we'll see what The Walking Dead looks like when it comes back now that Frank Darabont has left the show.
Goodness. What did you think of part two, Chris?
I agree with you that it's a bit of a letdown after part one. I think anything that they did would be a bit of a letdown after part one. Unless Patrick Stewart had not come back and he had remained a Borg and, you know, Riker becomes a captain, do something really unexpected like that, because you wouldn't expect the lead to actually leave the show. I think it was fine. I mean, it's still a very good episode, one of the great Star Trek episodes. Part one is definitely stronger. The way they got out of it in terms of Picard still having this connection to the collective, you know, set up a lot of what was used with the Borg in terms of the way they operate and the way our characters can communicate with them in future Star Trek episodes. I guess I felt it was a little bit easy to blow up the Borg cube by putting them to sleep at the end, you know, but I guess that they had to have a way to do that because they obviously weren't going to win a battle against them. So
yeah, I think Piller said he came up with that in like the last 10 hours or something. Like they needed to shoot the ending and it just sort of came to him that, yeah, they could do this.
Yeah, just find
it. It kind of has that feel to it, that's for sure. But
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. There was, of course, it wasn't possible to do at the time in terms of budgets and technology to show the actual battle of Wolf 359.
Yeah.
That would have been great. I think Michael Piller's solution of showing the aftermath of the battle was a very nice creative solution to get around the fact that there was just no way that they had the money to show that kind of battle.
That's got to be the best Starship graveyard, possibly until the JJ film. And maybe people would argue that it's better than the way the JJ film does it. It's really impressive. I'm glad we do eventually see the battle in Emissary. Yeah.
Yes, but we do. Like the next, not the next year, but what, 93 in Emissary, we do finally get to see the battle.
But
of
it kind of works. It kind of works better here where we don't see it and we just see the destruction. Yeah. It's really quite horrific. I think that's in part two, and it's probably the best part of it.
Yeah, I agree. It's so much more effective only seeing the aftermath and not really. It leaves something to the viewer's imagination of just how fast the Borg must have gone through it, how much the Federation ships just kind of crashed like waves on the rocks and didn't really do anything. It leaves a blank for your brain to fill in, and your brain is much better at filling in those blanks than a television budget is often in those circumstances.
Yeah, we do get the one shot of the Mars defense submarines coming after the Borg cube and just getting blown out of the sky.
It also works better with the emotional elements of this episode, mm-hmm. both the first part and the second part, to connect with you as a viewer by just showing you the aftermath instead of you getting caught up in some kind of action movie with, like in First Contact, where we actually have a brief big battle with the Borg. I like this solution a lot.
Definitely.
All right. So I guess we're at the end of the episode there. It's of course, all kinds of elements that we could talk about, but I think the key to the best of both worlds is just the fact that it was not only the turning point for The Next Generation, which turned The Next Generation into a truly great show, but it is largely responsible, I think, for giving us Deep Space Nine and Voyager and even Enterprise and all the other movies, because it solidified the fan acceptance of The Next Generation and really accelerated the growth of modern fandom and spurred along what became, by the time we got to like 94, 95, just this incredibly massive Star Trek franchise, both on the small screen, big screen, merchandising, conventions, and everything was just crazy. And I really trace a lot of it back to this episode, to the best of both worlds.
Star Trek V and arguably season 1 and 2 of TNG could have really torpedoed Star Trek if they hadn't really turned things around. So I'm definitely in agreement with you that this is always the episode I hear people point to, where should I start with TNG? And, maybe you watch Encounter at Farpoint and a couple episodes in there, but see Best of Both Worlds, if you're new to TNG, and that'll show you what the show is really like and what the potential is.
Right. Don't start with the Royale.
Don't start with Shades of Grey.
Well, you can get a lot of backstory from Shades of Grey.
That's true.
Yeah.
All right. You have any last thoughts about Best of Both Worlds, Brian?
I think we did a good job covering it. Watching it again, just to say it again, I was really surprised at just how strong it was on a character and an interpersonal dramatic level, which is, what Star Trek isn't always the greatest at. When Star Trek falls into its kind of patterns, it can turn into a negative space wedgie of the week that they have to tech to beat. And then you just kind of have characters going through the same old motions. But Best of Both Worlds is really, really solid television, because it's a guy wrestling with an issue, wrestling with a personal decision, and there just happens to be space zombies attacking at the same time. And really, really good television.
Yeah, I think my expectations were possibly a little off for this one, because I've been watching Voyager, I guess, most recently, and a Borg episode means a lot of space battles. It means a lot of computer-generated imagery. It means Jerry Ryan. And this was none of those things. This was an intense character drama, which is actually better, but it wasn't quite what I was expecting. It's kind of like I saw The Untouchables in the theater, and you go in wanting like a slam bam action movie like you're used to, and you're not going to get that. You're going to get a slow character drama with a lot of interesting conversations that you kind of have to follow and get invested in. You're not just going to be able to come in for the battle. You kind of get the battle in part two, but for the most part, the best part of this episode is Riker dealing with whether or not he becomes a captain. And I'll be interested as I watch a little bit more, you know, in sequence, how Riker continues to deal with that, because obviously he doesn't become a captain until Nemesis.
Right. All right. Well, Brian, thanks for joining us again today.
Oh, thank you. Anytime.
And, why don't you take a quick second and tell people where they can find you and down in front.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm on Twitter, so you can find me at Brian Finifter on Twitter, BrianFinifter. And I'm a co-host on the podcast called Down in Front. We record our own commentaries to movies. We sit down and we watch a movie, and we record our own commentary towards. We have conversations, and hopefully they're funny and insightful and entertaining. And you can find us at downinfront.net, and you can also Down in Front also has a Twitter, Down in Front on Twitter, and we have a great forum, and we have over 200 something episodes at this point. So go to our website and check it out, find a movie you love, and download the podcast, sync it up, and check it out.
All right, and with that, we'll issue the command: sleep,
sleep, Data.
Well, Greg, I'm glad to see that your skin is still nice and pink-colored there and it hasn't all been turned gray by the Borg.
Well, like I said last week, Florida is a terrible place to be assimilated, but Seattle would actually be a pretty nice place. I wouldn't mind living out my Cybertronic days next to Green Lake and by the shore.
Right. Well, I'll be still here in Tokyo, so... Well, I'm glad Brian could join us today for the discussion. Always a fun discussion when he's on the show.
Yeah, he's great.
I suspect that our listeners must have some views about Best of Both Worlds they want to share with us, one of the most beloved of all Star Trek episodes. Yeah. So if anyone out there does have something to share with us, please drop by trek.fm/contact and leave us a message. Or you can leave us a voicemail by calling 646-652-TREK. You can also sign up as a member of Trek FM, and you can comment on the show page there if you want, and Facebook as well. We've had some messages from some fans on readers on Facebook here the past couple of days. Some great feedback on our show about Star Trek V, in fact, that was posted by Jeff Corvery and also Jason Martin Schlierman. And some other notes from a group called Addicted to the Gene Roddenberry, Rick Berman Star Trek.
Ooh,
I think
nice.
I need an acronym for them. So we appreciate all your support of the show. And also Jack Com, one of our Twitter followers, left us a great review on iTunes.
Yeah, thanks,
all right,
guys.
Well, where else can people find us, Greg?
Well, they can find both of us tweeting as Trek FM on Twitter. I've been a little lax trying to get over my jet lag, but by the time you're hearing this, I should be tweeting away, especially as I'm continuing my watching of Next Gen now that I have Netflix. But then I have my own personal account, which is Greg Harbin. That's GregHarb as in boy, IN. And where can we find you on Twitter?
I'm also on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. I'm tweeting about Star Trek on there a lot. Now that college football season has started, I'm also tweeting a lot about college football. But as I have found, a number of people like Larry Nemechek and Dayton Ward, very well-known people within the Star Trek community, are big college football fans as well. And I'm having a great time talking to them on Twitter. So drop by and talk to me about Star Trek or football or whatever you want to talk about. I'm always up for conversation. So.
Yeah. And I want to mention, I'm going to be putting together a Seattle meetup soon. So if you're in the Pacific Northwest area, give me an at reply or a DM on Twitter, and I will put you in the list to be invited once details start getting put together. Really looking forward to meeting a bunch of you that I've been already talking to.
Yeah, do that. And we'll put a note on Trek FM as well once you get that organized, Greg, so people can come on there and have easy access to the information. And also, while you're at Trek FM, let me just remind you to test your Trek IQ by playing Trek Trivia at trek.fm/trektrivia and follow username Trek Trivia on Twitter, where Mark Stamper and Anthony Davis run live quizzes several times a week. Well, Greg, another Ready Room is finished for us and another great conversation about Star Trek. So I'm going to head off now and put together Hyper Channel.
Yeah, Chris, I think it's time to stick a flesh color removing probe in it, because the Ready Room is done.
Thank you.